The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest is a familiar presence in movies and television and on stage and in all of show business, which she has pursued for her entire life.
Yes.
Welcome, Annette O'Toole. Hi, Annette.
Thank you, Leonard and Jesse. That's a lovely introduction.
I have to tell you that when I found out that you worked with Danny Kaye, my jealousy, he's one of my heroes.
Oh, yeah. One of my heroes.
And I don't know that there's ever been another like him, like him. But you worked with him as a kid. Like, that's incredible.
Not only that, that was my very first professional job ever. I grew up in Houston, Texas. My mom and my aunt were dancing school teachers. And so because of my brilliant talent, they brought me out here to Los Angeles. And that was the first, they were friends with another dancing teacher out here named Al Gilbert. And so Al was friends with Tony Sharmalee, who was a choreographer for the Danny Kaye Show. And he came and saw me dance, and they were doing a big production number with Gwen Verdon, who was my idol, still is.
What? Yeah.
And I got to play the young Gwen Verdon in this very short little piece I did in this big production number that was to the tune of Real Live Girl. So Danny sang and danced with a little girl, then me as the middle one, and then Gwen. And it was so exciting to be part of it. He was so lovely to me. I've heard stories since, you know, that he was not the nicest man always to people or whatever. But anybody I've talked to about him has only had good things to say about him. And I certainly do, because he was just lovely. And I got to sit around and observe. It was a big production number, so I was sitting on the sidelines watching. And it was a wonderful, and my mother took my paycheck to City National Bank, because that was the name of the bank on, that was who issued the check. And she took it to the teller and she said, I want you to count out the first $5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I have framed down in my den my first dollar bill. And it says for Dancing with Danny Kaye on the Danny Kaye Show, August 7th, 1965.
Wow.
So I will never forget.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's just wonderful.
The whole experience is incredible, but also well done, mom.
Yeah, really. I know. Because who knew at that time? I mean, I'd ever do anything or, you know, but it's a nice conversation piece in the den, which is also called the Walker Room for Walker, Texas Ranger, because when Michael and I were getting together, that was our favorite show. We'd watch with the kids because we had two kids each and we were trying to blend this family. And that was a wonderful way to get everybody on board, you know, to be, have fun and laugh and jump around and kick and pretend we're hitting people with cue sticks.
Well, that's part of, that's not part of Chuck Norris's official bio.
Yeah.
Somehow, I don't think he'd mind having.
No, I'm sure Chuck would be fine with it. Yeah. And we have a framed picture of him over our television. I wish this were video so you could see all these things. I would take you around and show you.
Oh my God.
I'm just thinking about if your mom, who's still
Yes.
Alive and well.
Yes, she is.
If she went into a bank today, they'd ask her, are you sure you don't want an NFT instead of that George Washington photo on the engraved bill?
I know.
No.
I remember when I got my first bank book. What an exciting thing that was.
Yes, for me too. And my first library card. And,
yes.
Michael has a polio pioneers card. He does. He was one of the first to get the polio vaccine.
Oh, my.
Meet Dr. Salk. I met Dr. Salk when I was a kid because I had good grades and they sent me from my school over to wherever his big facility was. Somewhere near here, near enough to take a bus. Mm-hmm. And so five of us from our class got to go and meet him. It was amazing.
My mom's building in the Bronx was one of the very first to get the vaccine because two boys in her building died from polio. So that's her fun talk, right? Polio. It is fascinating. It is a fascinating because for anybody around my parents' age, it was such a massive thing that, I mean, not just the illness, but getting the shots. And it was such a big deal. And knowing that doctor, as you say, it's like
it was huge. And we went to my grammar school and had the vaccine on a sugar cube. I don't know if you had that, Leonard.
I do remember that.
The vaccine and you'd eat the sugar cube, which was, they should have done that for COVID. I think more people would have gotten it maybe if they could have.
A sugar cube.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where the song came from, honey. You know this. You don't know this? Robert Sherman's kid.
Yeah.
Got that vaccine and the sugar cube and told his father, well, you know, the sugar helps the medicine go down.
Yep.
And that thus a song was born.
I've known Richard Sherman my entire life, but I've never heard that before.
Wow. Well, he changed it to a spoonful instead of a cube.
Yes. A cube. Yes. A cube full of drugs injected by a needle makes the medicine go down. That's wild. Wow.
Well, we were very lucky that we got to take it. We felt so fortunate and brave and excited to get it.
As you should.
Oh, yeah.
We should mention that, as you've said, Michael, your husband is Michael McKean.
Yes.
Pretty talented guy.
Oh, he's okay.
You know, he's all right. He's all right. He's worked for a while.
Oh, yeah. Not as long as I have. He's older than I am, but hasn't worked as long. So I always have to, you know.
I was going to say, not that we rub it in.
No,
but no, that's very funny. No, and Mike, I mean, the amazing thing always, they always talk about careers are, you can't plan. Like you say, like your mom didn't know in framing that $1, if that was the only dollar you were going to earn that way.
Right.
But it was something special. And to think about just how many things, all the places that you go, as you say, you were just saying that Michael is in London right now filming. Mm-hmm. You're about to head back to Canada. Mm-hmm. The places you go, the people you meet, the different sort of lives you lead, and every set, I always feel like every set is like its own little family.
It is.
Yeah. And you have dozens, if depending on who you are, hundreds of them over the years. And it's its own world.
It is. It's kind of a wonderful way to travel because everything's taken care of for you. You know, they live here. Well, let's go eat here today, you know, and we're going to take you
okay.
Well, I was doing a TV movie in, it started out in London and then we went to Luxembourg. And so when we were in Luxembourg, I took my kids, my mom and dad came and took care of the kids. And we stayed in this funny, looked like a little tiny castle. It was wonderful. My kids had a great time. And I get in the car in the morning and I go off somewhere and I'd act all day. It was a Danielle Steele show and I was in every frame of it. And so I was so exhausted and I'd come home and try to be a mom, which was hard. So I'd get in the car and I'd be going home at night. I'd say, Renee, I think was my driver. I said, where was I today? I said, oh, you were in Germany today. I said, what? Oh, I didn't even know that. Have I been there before? No. So it was very exciting to go to all these places. And when you had time off, you could really investigate and you'd stay there long enough where you'd get to know the place, like Luxembourg. The kids would start playing with these kids in the park and they'd see them every day. And it was some of their happiest memories going with me to different locations. And at the time I was so guilty. I thought, oh God, I'm taking them away from their school and their home and everything they know. And no, that's all they remember now.
Yeah.
All right, so here, this is my knee-jerk reaction to your saying that. Okay, name the best location you've ever been on.
Best location was probably London. I've been to London a lot, a couple of things I've done. And then Michael's worked in London, so I've gone with him. Mm-hmm. I just love London. I just was there and I hadn't been there for about 5 years. Mm. And so we stayed this time in Camden.
Oh, Camden's a lot of fun.
I've never been in that. I mean, I've gone to the markets and stuff, but we stayed right, his apartment's right over the, where the barges go by and they open up the gates and you see, and it was something I'd never seen before. And it's like an over 200 year old system.
Yeah.
That goes all, not just in London, but goes all the way up to like Yorkshire or someplace.
Yep.
It's incredible. And you think this way they've been doing it, they're still doing it. And you just feel connected to, you know, Dickens and all those characters.
There are canals.
Yeah.
All through, especially England, all of these canals that go through the different cities.
Yeah.
And people who live there in some cases don't even know they're there. Danny's brother is one of the ones in charge of the canals in Manchester. Mm. One of my best friends. My husband is from Manchester and I love the UK, so I go as much as I can. But the canals are still used regularly. Mm-hmm. That's how they move stuff. It's wild.
It's so much fun to watch because every time you look at it would be a different boat. And one went along one time called Eggy, E-G-G-Y, Eggy. And so when I left, I said, Michael, keep a lookout for Eggy. I just want to know if Eggy goes by. He said, no, he hasn't seen it since. But he got to know some ducks. He's gorgeous, huge, like tan. We called him the Tannies. We called him Vic Tanny. And, I said, how are the Tannies today? So we set up this whole life there. But yeah, the canals are amazing. And they have party boats go by. And then they put a funny little veil on the girl who's, I guess, the bride. And then they all scream, yay, we're partying. It's
all right. Now let me finish my little cycle here.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Then I'll go on about my business. The worst location you've ever been on.
Oh my God, Spokane, Washington. It was pretty bad. I wasn't there very long. And I love Washington, but I'd never been to Spokane, but we were in a hotel and I couldn't go anywhere. I was on call. I'd be like on call all day till the evening. And it felt kind of dangerous. And I'd walk around. I think, is this all right for me to be walking here? I don't know. And there was, they only had meat at the hotel restaurant. There wasn't any restaurant around where you could kind of go. And it was just like, if you didn't want steak, you were out of luck. So I don't know. That was the first one that came to mind. I've mostly been to wonderful places.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Spokane. I don't mean to put you down. I'm sure there are gorgeous places, but I just didn't go to those.
No, look, this is the whole thing, right? Is you get to a place and depending on what it is you need from it, it's like that. There, if you were just trying to get away, if you were trying to escape for a few days, then nothing could be wonderful.
Right.
But if you are somewhere for a longer time and there are no restaurants, there's nothing to sort of get out to do or see, it can be tough.
And you're feeling some pressure from the job at hand.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Don't listen. Don't sugarcoat it. Don't make it easy for me. Mostly it's wonderful and it's, everything's taken care of for you. And if you have to have a bad location every once in a while, so what? Yeah. My God, we get to have the best job in the world.
Yep.
Didn't complain about anything.
I've often heard Winnipeg. Winnipeg seems to be one that,
Yeah. I think Michael's been to Winnipeg. I think he did Mystery Alaska up there, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
All right. So now you've been on the Danny Kaye Show. You've had this wonderful introduction to big time showbiz here in Hollywood as a tiny tot. And what then?
Mostly I auditioned and studied. I was like on My Three Sons and The Courtship of Eddie's Father. And I did Blue Denim at the Callboard Theater on Melrose Place, which I actually was 15 then. So I was waiting to be 18 basically, because nobody would hire me really for any big jobs because I had to have a teacher and I couldn't work long hours and it was really boring and horrible. And I couldn't wait to be 18. So while I was going to Hollywood Professional School and which is, anyway, that's a whole other story. But so the guidance counselor there encouraged me to apply to college. And I said, this is pointless. I don't want to go to college. I've been waiting on, like, for at least 5 years to be old enough to really act. She said, well, they have a really good theater program and everything. You should just apply just in case, so you have something to fall back on. I said, but that's not an issue. I won't have to have anything to fall back on. So I was kind of had blinders on about that, which is kind of stupid. I wish, in retrospect, I wish I'd gone. So I did go for one day. I was accepted. I went for one day and they said, no, you have to do all your academic stuff in the first 2 years. I said, I'm out of here. No. And my mother stopped payment on the check. I think we're the only people who got out of paying the deposit. So I immediately got into a production of West Side Story at the Inner City Cultural Center, which was directed by Lonnie Chapman, who is, I just saw the other day on I Have Gun Will Travel as the guest star. And he's a wonderful actor. If you don't know him, he's one of those great.
And a very busy actor.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah. And he was a lovely, lovely man. And so I played Baby John's girlfriend, Clarice, and met Tony Geary, who was in that production. And it was so much fun. And we all played other parts. The play didn't really work because it was like we had Puerto Ricans on the Jets and everybody's kind of mixed up. And I was the Jet girlfriend, but I was understudying Rosalie, who's the kind of the girl who sings America with Anita.
In
the big America scene, because in the play, it's the two women are singing it. So our Maria went out. So our Rosalia was her understudy. So she stepped up. So I stepped into Rosalia, but I had all the dance stuff in the Jets, in the dance at the gym and in the Somewhere Ballet. So I was on both sides. And the poor kids who were watching us, because they bring these kids in from all the different high schools at 10 in the morning, we'd be doing West Side Story. So they didn't know who I was. They said, well, they see me up close because we were up and down the aisles. The Jets are going to have their day tonight, you know. And then I'd be up doing, America. So anyway, so I did that. And then I turned 18 miraculously. And I studied with a wonderful actor named Robert Ellenstein, actor teacher, who in North by Northwest is one of the guys who kidnaps Cary Grant in the beginning, the one with the hat. And he was lovely and he taught me so much. And I was very lucky to be getting hired so that I could put into practice the things I was working on in class. I then later studied with Peggy Fury and met so many wonderful people there, are still friends of mine. And the same thing, it continued. I was getting, more parts and kind of more notoriety. And it was great fun to experiment. I loved TV. I loved episodic television. And I still do, because you can make some mistakes and learn. And it's just a wonderful training ground.
Well, you've done all of the things.
Pretty much.
it is definitely, so there's, as much as it's always acting, it is different, you know, are you, and this is actually obviously because I grew up watching a lot of older movies, something that I had to sort of adjust to. And when I show friends older films, I have to remind them that a lot of the people that they're watching were theater people and they're playing to the back of the house, except the camera is here.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's an adjustment.
Yeah.
Because you have to say the reason that they're yelling is because I don't understand.
The style was more declamatory.
Yeah.
In the 30s. Yeah. And yes. Then 40s, after World War II, of course, everything changed with the coming of Brando. And
Right. He changed everything.
His acolytes and his idolators and all of that.
Right. And also, don't you think, Leonard, that the fact there were so many big musicals, that was the other thing. In general, everybody was bigger, but also the musicals made you be big, and it was singing and big singing, like Judy Garland, and it was wonderful and exciting. Those are some of my favorite movies. Meet Me in St. Louis.
Oh, God,
and Wizard of Oz.
A friend of mine just asked me if I'd seen Calamity Jane. She said, I just saw this movie, Calamity Jane. I said, I think I've been watching that since I was three, and
absolutely.
It was exciting to me that she found it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And loved it.
You know what I was thinking the other day? I was watching, what movie was it? It was Carmen Miranda and God, who else was in it? All I could see was Carmen Miranda. And I thought, man, she's like Betty Hutton. She's like Betty Hutton with a turban. It was the same kind of like big, you know, all this big facial makeup, because I love Betty Hutton.
Yeah.
And Robert Osborne did an interview with Betty Hutton that I saw, and I was just in tears. I just thought it was the most wonderful thing. She just, oh, you know, her decline was so, so heartbreaking, you know, and she'd had such a big career. And anyway, it's the actors are just amazing. I mean, everybody is, but you get to see actors, you get to see them age, you get to see how they began and then how they, I mean, I was thinking this morning about, it's weird to be in a place now where I remember people so well and they're gone now. And I think when I first met them, little did I know I would outlive them by 10 years or I would do this or that. It's a funny part of getting older. You know, I still love to work. I still find such joy in it and excitement in it. And I can't ever think of retiring. I can't even imagine it.
Yeah.
And I've been very lucky to keep being asked to do it.
Well, you're about to go into your fifth season on Virgin River on Netflix.
Yes.
And you're the mayor of Virgin River.
Yes, I am.
Yes, I am.
I am the mayor. It's a really fun show. I get to work with Tim Matheson, who I've known for maybe 40 years. I worked with Tim on this this anthology series called The Class of 65. Whatever happened to The Class of 65? And I played the town. I played the class Trollope.
Typecasting. I get it.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. And he was my husband. And I said, Tim, what are you going to do next? And he said, oh, I'm going to go do this movie. I don't know. It's called Animal House. I don't know if it's going to be any good, but it'll be fun. We're going to go to Oregon. So, you know, a few years later, we see what happened. But it's fun to work with Tim, and I worked with him a few times. And it's an amazing show. It kind of blew up globally. It's I think the third or fourth most streamed show in the world. It's crazy.
Again, this is a whole, there are so many changes that have happened over the last few years, including the fact that stuff that you've done 20, 30, 40 years ago can be accessible.
Yeah.
We talked to some directors who they couldn't see their own movies and now they're streaming on Disney Plus or whatever it is. And suddenly people are saying, oh, hey, I just saw such and such for the first time. And they're going, you did?
Yeah.
and for you, this, I always think about with acting, you know, you're saying all of these years, I can't imagine what it's like to watch yourself. Cause it's enough for, you know, if I'm watching and I'm going, oh, I first started watching you when I was 5 and you were 10. Well, now I'm 36. Wait, how old are you again? Like, hang on a second.
36.
How did this happen? You know,
I'm sure a lot of younger at the time, younger viewers know you as Ma Kent.
Yeah.
On Smallville.
Yeah.
Right.
And you, that show was huge.
You and John Glover spent 6 years in Smallville.
Yeah, and John stayed on longer than that. We're still very, very good friends. Mm-hmm. I did my 6 years. I did my time. And and then I went back for a few guest star roles. And it was fun to see everybody and be plugged into this show that it's like, I hadn't watched it even when I was on it very much. It just, you know, it was fun. But I know what this is. And it'll just be heartbreaking because they keep cutting my scenes because I'm not like, I was just, you know, if they were running short, they'd put my scene in. But it was a really wonderful show. And it completely made the CW. I mean, for better or worse, that's the mold that they're still following. But the great thing was that John and I became such good friends out of it. We would fly up together and fly back together. Our schedules were pretty similar. And we lived right around the corner from one another. And we'd go out to dinner all the time. And I had to call him and tell him that this Japanese noodle house that we used to go to is now closed. And there's so many things just, you know, with COVID just disappeared. So we had some fun times. They do big shows where they throw the noodles and they, you know, throw them around and then you'd eat them.
Was this also Vancouver or somewhere else?
Yeah, Vancouver. I've been going to Vancouver since the first thing I did in Vancouver was Stephen King's It.
Wow.
In 1990.
Wow. And
then I did various and sundry you know, TV shows. And then I got Smallville, and that was 6 years. And now Virgin River, which is going on 5 years, except for the year, the first year of COVID when I didn't go, because I was, it was very complicated. It was really hard. There was no vaccine. My mother was 94.
Yeah.
Michael couldn't come. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get up there and be separated from my family and not know. Cause I thought if somebody gets COVID, that adds on another 2 weeks. So I could be up there a year.
Yep.
And I just couldn't commit to it. And it was one of the, maybe the first time I'd ever said no to something that I was already part of. Cause when I commit to something, I do it. But I felt terrible about it. I was worried they were going to sue me, but they were lovely about it. They said, oh no, would you do some shows from home? So my daughter, Anna, who is works on film crews, came over and shot me on her iPhone. She shot 4 scenes of me on a Zoom call. With Tim.
So you stayed on the show via iPhone.
Yeah,
I did. They kept me, my character alive until they almost killed me off. So I don't get killed off because obviously I'm talking to you about going up again.
Yes.
So, but our new season will drop this month on the 20th. The weird thing to me is that they show them all at once. Like somebody can sit for however many hours that is and watch the whole, everything we did for 5 or 6 months. They see.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's all so different.
Yeah.
And like everything, some things are good and some things are bad.
Yeah.
It is strange to think that you can watch. I mean, we know how long movies can take to make. The idea that, you know, they appear and they disappear if they're streaming.
Yeah.
The idea with TV shows that if it's on at the, if it debuts at the right time, and if Netflix does the algorithm and it appears here in 5 minutes, something can be the most popular show in the world.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That's what
happened with this show. It just happened. It came out during the pandemic and people desperately needed entertainment and also to be taken away from this horror that we
were. Yep. Yeah, also exactly.
About. So it just became, and there's no COVID in Virgin River. We never talked about it. It's never talked about. So it's this whole other universe, and it's beautiful. And it's got lovely stories and people who care about one another in a small town where, you know, people think they want to live. I've lived in a small town. It's not always wonderful. But anyway, it was a good show anyway, but it just hit at the right time.
Right. But if it weren't for another TV movie, you might not have met your husband.
That's true. Well, I had met Michael. I had met him many, many years ago when he was doing Laverne and Shirley. And I was with Bruno Kirby for 8 years. So we traveled in the same kind of, you know, young Hollywood circle.
Mm-hmm.
So I would see Michael at various, you know, screenings and parties at Rob Reiner's house and things like that. And I always thought he was very nice, but we never got to know one another. But in 1997, I was still living in Ashland, Oregon, the small town of which I spoke. And I was going to do this Lifetime movie called Fine. I always get the final. I did two final movies, Final Descent and Final Justice, Final Justice. And they were right together. We're one right after the other.
Perfect.
Not sequels, just happening at final in the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the part Michael played was this sleazy lawyer, and Ron Silver was going to do the part. It was offered to Ron Silver, and Ron Silver passed because we both know Ron Silver, and he said he'd played one too many sleazy lawyers. So the director, Tommy Lee Wallace, who had directed Stephen King's It, was just a huge Spinal Tap fan and offered the role to Michael. I think admired Michael, but mostly just wanted to talk about Spinal Tap. So Michael came up, and I re-met him in Portland, Oregon, and we just became really good friends. He was seeing someone. We were both divorced, had been for 4 or 5 years apiece. And I was not interested in all I wanted to do was get back to LA, which I was in the process of doing. I was had a year to get my stuff together. The kids were gonna go into middle school and into high school and get us a place to live and all this stuff. So it's not like I was looking for a boyfriend at all, just the very opposite. But he was just so lovely. And he was the only other actor besides Richard Thomas who would bring a book to set. And I always brought my book to set. And sometimes we just sit there and both be reading. And he brought a book an Anne Rule book called Dead by Sunset. I said, I'm the title character in that, you know. So when we did the TV movie, I played the woman who's killed and who was dead by sunset.
Amazing.
It's by the Sunset Highway in Portland. So I can't remember what I was reading at the time, but he had a birthday in the very first few days, I think right before we began shooting. And I gave him a book I just read called Cold Mountain, which I loved and thought he would enjoy, not knowing him very well. And it's on our bookshelf in the living room. I inscribed it to him. And then we just kept in touch through email, which was very new to me. I hadn't done that for very long. And he would just write to me and say, oh, Elvis Costello's on blah, blah, blah tonight on PBS. Did you watch that? And it was that kind of thing. And
sure.
And he had a girlfriend and who I knew, it was a lovely woman who'd come to the set. And I said one time in the email, I said, how's Lauren doing? And he said, Lauren's doing a pilot in Toronto. It's just as well. And I thought, oh, okay. Still not having designs or anything on him.
Mm-hmm.
But he invited me. I was coming to LA to look at schools for the girls. So he said, while you're here, do you want to go see Bob Dylan, Van Morrison, and Joni Mitchell on their tour that they're doing? I said, he could barely get the words out. First, yes. So we did that, and we fell in total love. I mean, it was just a wonderful connection because I think because I knew him so well from having worked with him, you know, just seeing how somebody is at their work. And he was just such an interesting, fun, amazing person. He would call me in Oregon when I was still living there. And we just talk about things like Leonard, remember the Passing Parade? They still play it sometimes on TCM. That was a big thing in my life. I don't know why. I love the theme music. Da, 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 da. And we would both sing that to each other on the phone. We just got to know each other so well over the phone after we'd worked together. And then when we got together, it felt like we'd known each other, you know, like we'd been best friends as kids. That's how it felt. And who had happened to fall in love. So, you know, I'm knocking wood because it's gotten better and better. And for us, the whole COVID thing was wonderful because it was the most time we ever spent consecutively together. And it was fantastic. That's why it's really hard now to be apart.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot, I've heard a lot of actors talk about that.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks who travel a lot. My husband travels a lot for work and we normally travel a lot. We had never spent more than probably like 2 months straight together, my husband and I. And suddenly it was over a year. And, you know, we hate each other now, but it's fine. No,
what does your husband do?
My husband does lighting for tours, and shows and venues. Yeah. So in the UK, he toured with big shows there. One of the ones that he was with for years is called Blood Brothers, which is a very British. Yeah. He was with that for a long time.
Oh my God.
And now he does it here, but yeah, so we'd never been together that much.
Uh-huh.
And we discovered that we did in fact like each other. And that's
that nice
thing
to know that you made the right choice.
Yeah.
And that's good. Oh, that's wonderful.
So many people had that experience. As I say, a lot of folks were used to traveling and it is really lovely.
It is.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, no one would wish this pandemic on the world, of course.
No, God, no.
But it did have some unexpected, very unexpected benefits.
Yeah.
And one of them is enforced.
Retirement.
Yeah.
In a weird way. But yeah, it was nice because we were all in the same boat too.
Yes.
It wasn't like, it's just our household and all these other people are getting to have fun and go do work. You know, no, every single person. And it was kind of, in a weird way, nice when you'd hear other people, you know, weren't getting their jobs like they normally get over you. So it was kind of even leveling. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
But as you say, making the decision that you had to, you know, that's a big, I think you made the right one for yourself.
Yeah.
But that's such a tough, and everybody having to deal with that, with constantly getting quarantined, not able to see friends and family. You know, again, I heard so many stories, people talking about that their family is used to coming to set all the time and then they couldn't. How that felt for folks, especially when you guys are far away.
This is how
the nomad actor and family have learned to deal with things. You go to London, and then Michael comes to Vancouver. And when you can't, it's like, this is no fun.
Yeah, it was really scary. Plus, you have this thing that could kill you.
Yeah, also COVID.
That you can't see. It's this invisible monster.
Yeah.
And you don't know. And at that time, we weren't sure where it was coming from, how you could really get it. We were wiping down the groceries that were being delivered out front. We, you know, our kids would come over and stand in the driveway, and we just kind of wave to them. And, you know, it was really, I think back, it's like, thank God, you know, you go on from that. You don't, like, you know, you'd never have another child if you really thought about how painful it was the first time. That it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know,
we've all lived through a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
And we're still living in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are. Yeah. This new
on a more benign topic. Yes. How did you and Michael come to write the song? That lovely, lovely song that caps off Christopher Guest's movie, A Mighty Wind.
Well, it was right after 9/11. I was September 10th, 2001. I had flown up to Vancouver to do the second episode of Smallville. We just started doing the show, and of course, the world came apart the next morning, and I immediately said, I'm going home. I thought, oh my God, every big city is going to get hit. Now they're going to hit LA, and I'm going to be there with them. I don't want to be somewhere else if we're all going to, you know, be hurt. So I drove down. I rented a car and I drove down. It took me a day and a quarter. And they called me and said, we want you back up in Vancouver. And Michael said, well, we're going together. So we got in the car, turned right around and went back. And on the way, somewhere between Portland and Seattle, I had this weird little tune running through my head, not Kiss at the End of the Rainbow, but another song. And I sang it to Michael and I said, am I making this up, or is this something you know? He said, no, you're making that up. Let's write like mnemonic lyrics to it. And I said, what's mnemonic? And he had to tell me what it was so that we would remember the melody.
Yeah.
Because we had there weren't iPhones to
that
you could sing it into the thing and remember it or record it and sell it. So we got to, we came up with words, da, 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 potatoes in the paddy wagon, da, 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 da. So we wrote this song, finished it when we got to Vancouver. And Michael said, you know, I think this could be good for A Mighty Wind, because Chris Guest was gathering all original, different types of folk music. So I had happened to start, like, not on purpose, but it ended up being something that might be useful. So he told Chris about it. And when we got back to LA, we sang for him. He said, oh yeah, that could work for the new Main Street Singers. Great. So he asked Michael if Michael would be interested in writing this kind of signature song for Mitch and Mickey that would be sung at the end of the show. And he said, the only thing is, it has to have a kiss. We have to know, we have to wonder, are they going to kiss or not? So it just has to have a kiss in it. So Michael said, do you want to write this song with me? I said, yes. He said, I'm thinking something like about a kiss at the end of the rainbow. So we sat down and we wrote the song in about an hour.
And it was such a lovely song.
It was based on us, and it was based on all that being apart from one another. We'd been apart, but even early in our relationship, we'd mostly been apart. So all the kind of the fairy tale references that's kind of me, you know, thinking of along those lines. But it's a blend musically. Almost everything we write is a blend musically and lyrically. There have been a few where I've written the lyrics and he's written the music and vice versa, but that one was a real blend. And when it kind of took off and became a character in the movie, it was so thrilling. And Michael had written so much more of the music in it. And I contributed to one more song. So I have three songs kind of represent me in the movie, and it was a wonderful way to start. And it was really thrilling. And I think at that time, now if you're in the music branch, you get sent either cassettes anymore. some sort of
a file. You get a file.
Yeah.
A file. Thank you. A file. of all the music that's been submitted. And at that time, people came up to us afterwards, after Eugene and Catherine had done this beautiful rendition of it on the Academy Awards. And they said, oh, if I'd heard that song, I would have voted for you. I thought, well, isn't it your job? You're only five. You could find a way to listen to them. Even if you didn't want to see the movie, I'm sure you could find a way. But people in the music department were saying that. I thought, well, that's not odd. That's not making me feel better.
Yeah.
And so it was the Lord of the Rings year, though, the third Lord of the Rings. And it was everything won. So whatever it had Lord of the Rings on, yep, check that off.
Sure.
So we didn't, but it was an amazing field. It was Elvis Costello and T-Bone Burnett from the Cold Mountain Song.
Yeah.
Cold Mountain was nominated that year. And the Triplets of Belleville had a brilliant song, that French song. And Sting had a song from something. And I can't remember who else. Oh, and the Lord of the Rings. So it was
you were very good company.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it was like, whoever won, it's like, okay, I'll let Elvis.
Fair enough. Yeah. You know, I was very pleased to discover, because this morning I was thinking about it and I said, I wonder, there are a bunch of different performances, you guys singing it live, you and Michael singing it live.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun to hear it. It's fun to hear our version because in the movie, they switch parts. Eugene sings the melody and Catherine sings the harmony, because Catherine has a more prominent voice.
Sure.
People think that's the melody. And I was kind of complained, not I love their version, but I said to Michael, you know, people don't really know what the song really is the way we did it. He said, but that's what folk music is all about.
Mm.
He said, everybody has taken those songs. So that is in keeping with the whole idea of folk music.
It becomes yours.
Absolutely. That's right. But our version is my favorite version in terms of not performance so much, but with the way it's sung, you know, the melody.
Now, when it came to be that we were pitched is the word, right? Doing an interview with you by.
I hope Jeff told you how quickly we responded, by the way.
Well, all I knew is I said, I'm not going to be here long. I'm going to be in Vancouver. And he said, well, let me see what I can do. So,
yep.
And then you guys said, yes, you'd like to talk
in about yourself. 7 seconds. Yes.
And the first thing that popped in my head, the first thing was your movie Cross My Heart.
Oh,
and then I read that it's one of your favorite things too.
Oh, absolutely. It was my favorite movie to make because we almost did it like a play. It was mostly just Marty and me, especially
It's a film called Cross My Heart, which is a romantic comedy, but a somewhat serious romantic comedy, starring you and Martin Short. And at the time, Martin had never done anything really even approaching seriousness.
Yeah.
It was, you know, he was always bigger than life and farcical, which he does so beautifully and brilliantly.
Yeah.
But this was an attempt to sort of humanize his screen persona, and you were his partner in crime. And I haven't seen it in a long, long time, but I'm very fond of it.
Oh, thank you, Leonard. It was such a wonderful movie to make. I adore Marty. I always did. And working with him was an absolute dream. And my face would hurt at the end of the day. I'd be laughing so much all day long. It was hard. I'd have to like push it down because it was really painful. And we finished the movie and we, you know, they looked at it and everything. And then they went back and wanted to change the ending or add to the ending. I'm not exactly sure how we did, but anyway, by that time I was 6 months pregnant with my second daughter, so they had to shoot me from clavicle. Thank you. Clavicle. I started to say clavicle, and then I thought, wait a minute, clavier? No, that's French. German for piano.
Clavicle.
Yes. So yeah, I mean, they shot me maybe from the waist up. I wasn't too bad, but it was funny, those things that happen. And it was really fun. And Paul Reiser was great. And Joanna Kearns was in it, and who had been my classmate at Peggy Fury's class. And she played my sister. It was just, it's such a small, small community that we're in, really.
And that is why I, as I say, like this whole thing of I try to think about what it must be like, as I say, to start young and work all the way through, because it's enough for an audience member to watch you do that. But it's sort of like now when I see someone that I grew up watching who's around my age playing a parent. And you go, you're not old enough to be we are old enough to be parents.
I know.
You know, same thing. Someone suddenly can play a grandparent and you go, I guess they are, huh?
I could play great grandparent and it wouldn't be weird. You know, it's like, oh my God, it's very strange. It's, but you know, look, what else are we going to do? You just got to keep going on.
It's
unnatural to play. You know, that's why I stopped dyeing my hair and I will never have any kind of work done, because it's like, who are we trying to kid? You know, come on. You know what I looked like when I was 20, because you can see it on the TV. And that's not me. And I wouldn't want to look that way. There's something odd and horrible about it. I mean, I shouldn't say to each his own or her own.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's not mine.
But I mean, you've chosen to do that and it works for you.
Right.
Because you play normal people. You play.
I try to.
But I mean, you are growing old gracefully, to put it, to use a worn out phrase, but it suits this situation.
Well, thank you. It's the only way I know how to do it. I feel lucky to have gotten to this point, and I feel finally that I haven't learned everything, but I've learned some things, and I would never want to direct, because I'd always want to let the actors go early, because I wouldn't want them to be cold or hungry or upset or worried or any of those things. So I couldn't direct, but I've always thought I would like to coach actors, because so many times, especially now, I see young actors and I see if you could just kind of help, and it's like I can't say anything. It's not my place though, and
some people need it though.
But some people don't take it that way.
I know.
You have to be very careful, especially now. I didn't want to overstep my bounds, but I think if somebody had anything anybody told me, I was like a freaking sponge. I was soaking it up, you know, watching how they operated. Yeah. I did a movie with Jack Lemmon. He was probably the first big movie star, major movie star.
Right.
And he couldn't have been kinder, more wonderful to the crew, and I just thought, of course you can be that way, you just be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, that's just who he was. He was sort of angelic and funny, and you know, I just loved him.
There are things we're lucky, we speak to actors, directors, writers, all kinds, and one of the things that I think the smartest people you speak to are the ones who are sponges. And so if someone works with you, if they're smart, they should come over and ask you 7,000 questions about everything. But also there's that whole thing about being number one on a call sheet and setting the tone understanding what that means, which is that if you behave a certain way, nobody else can act like an idiot. Because if the lead's not, you know, if number one is treating people with respect and dignity, then it would be really weird if number 15 was acting like a jackass, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
What do you want most from a director when you're not on a continuing series like Virgin River, where you've been doing it, playing the same character and had a chance to explore it, and the writers have had a chance to explore it too. But in a movie or even in a stage play, what do you want from your director?
I just love guidance. You know, I feel like I'm pretty facile, and I think maybe that was that worked against me early on, because I never felt there was one way to do anything, and it certainly wasn't my way that I had figured out. I mean, I really feel that it's the writer's. It comes from the writer, and I can get as many clues as I can from the writer, but it's the director who, I remember the first time I worked with Jack O'Brien in a play in 1989 or something like that, 90 maybe. And he was the first director I'd had that freedom with. It was theater. So we had, you know, a lot of rehearsal. That's the problem with with movies, I think, is I haven't done a lot of movies where they say, yeah, we're going to rehearse for 6 weeks. You know, I didn't ever get to work with Mike Nichols and have that feeling of,
right,
yes, I know this inside out. So on a set, I just love guidance. I love them. I like them to be very specific and just say, I want you to go over there. And I like to figure out why. I don't need anybody to tell me why. I don't ask why. I figure it out, because I think that's the actor's job. It's not the director's job to tell you. He's got, or she's got 3,000 other things to do. And it's fun for me. It's like a detective novel. You know, I'm trying to figure out and pick up the clues and why are we, it's fun. I love it that it's fun like that. But Jack was, he was just excited. It was just so much fun to work with him. He just, Jack O'Brien, I don't know if people know who he is. He's primarily a theater director. He used to run. Well,
but like one of the handful of A-list theater directors of our, yeah, of our generation.
Yeah. Right. Michael was directed by him in Hairspray. Michael went in and replaced Harvey Fierstein on Broadway. So I got to see Jack again and see him in action again. And it was just, I don't know exactly what it was. It's just, he loves actors. He loves the whole process. He makes it thrilling and exciting and puts you in a place where you feel like you're discovering it. I think that's the key. Great directors kind of push you in a direction and see where you go. And then together you collaborate on it or I don't know. I when I read Mike Nichols' book, I just thought, oh God, I met him one time for The Fortune. And I walked in and I hadn't read the script. I didn't know what it was about. I knew it was about this girl gets kidnapped. And I walked in and he was so nice. And we sat down and he said, I just don't think you're the kind of girl who would ever have trouble getting a date or something like that. And I said, I didn't know what that meant because I hadn't read the script. He was operating on the premise that I knew what he was talking about, poor man. But I just loved meeting him. And I'm glad it didn't go longer than that because I would have been stuttering the whole time because I was just in such awe of him, especially after reading the book. My God, the life and the work and the work ethic and the brilliance and, oh, just amazing. Sure.
Well,
I'm a huge fan.
Mike Nichols fan.
Oh, God, who is?
And that's a great book. Mark Harris's biography is a must read. A must read.
It really
for anybody
is.
Who cares about film or theater.
And, it totally is. Mm-hmm. I and you know what is also in a book, a must read that I just had never read before? The Brothers Karamazov. I had never read that book. I had never read that book. And it's like, it's funny. It reminded me of Mike Nichols' book. I don't really know why, because people would go into situations. It wasn't anything like what I expected it to be. And I didn't read it. I listened to it on Audible. This incredible actor named Constantine Gregory, who I looked up because he's so wonderful. He's got a beautiful English accent, but he's also speaking all this Russian and French and stuff in the book. And I think he's got one Russian parent and one Dutch parent or something. And so he's got this wonderful background and he made each character so in this, I mean, that's the kind of acting that I do not know how to do. I don't know how somebody accomplished. When does he swallow? When does he take a drink of water? You know, because it was seamless. I just was so in awe. But the book itself, I really think actors, because that's what it does. It goes into the psyche of each person. And you think, oh, this is going to be a little scene between these two schoolboys. No. It goes into why this kid stuck another kid with a pencil and why, you know, it's like what that came out of and what his family background, it's a fantastic book. And I just finished it. So that's why I'm all 35 hours of it. So that's why I'm excited about it. I was walking in London listening to it and here in my home and listening to it. But listen to it. I think that was the key for me because you don't have time to drift off and think of other things.
He's an avid reader. My mom and I are both terribly dyslexic. She loves Audible for that reason.
Yeah.
But this one, just as many books as you want to give him, he will read. And
that's how Michael do.
Yeah, I'm a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
For
wow.
For
what's your favorite books. What's your favorite book, if you can say, if you can think of one?
Oh gosh. When I was a kid and I read Arrowsmith. This is like in middle school.
Wow.
Sinclair Lewis's Arrowsmith. It was an assignment and it made a big impression on me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big impression on me. And Dickens, I love Charles Dickens.
Yes. Oh my God.
David Copperfield, Great Expectations.
I always go back though to the book about the trains.
The book about
that you were just
Fred Harvey, Appetite for America, the story of Fred Harvey who moved west and helped build hotels and restaurants at railroad depots.
The Harvey girls.
Yes.
And then recruited young women.
And then got those young women married. It's fascinating. And whenever my dad's reading a book, me and my dyslexic twin over there, he just comes over and he's like our personal Cliff Notes.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
He'll read us his favorite parts and he'll tell us what he loves. And that to me still remains one of the books that you just, every part of it excited you.
Great story.
It's huge.
Yeah.
So
now we know that we're destined to be in a book club together.
That's right. Definitely.
And I'll send some up to Mystic River.
Virgin River. You send a Mystic River, it'll be Sean Penn who gets it.
That's right.
That would be pretty funny, though.
I will send some up to Virgin River, as Thank a matter you. Of fact. But continued success to you.
Thank you, guys.
We love watching you. You are so talented. It's a joy to watch what you do, because even though I know it's not effortless, that's what it feels like. And when you're there, it means that it's real.
Well, that's a huge compliment, Jesse. Thank you so much. The thing that's nice for me is when I go anywhere, people think they know me from their lives. Mm. And then I say, oh no, I'm an actress. And they say, oh yes. And I say, don't apologize. You just gave me the biggest compliment. You think you grew up with me. And,
yeah.
What you just said is hugely important to me. And I'm just so happy that I continue to get to do it and that people like it and continue to pay me.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
If you
you get paid for doing something that you truly love.
Yeah.
That's the key.
One of your daughters works on crew. Are both of your kids in film or just one?
Yes. My older daughter is an actress and a writer. And
what's her name?
Her name is Nell Geislinger.
Okay.
And she just did a play at South Coast Direct called Clean, which was wonderful. And she is gone to Montana to visit her boyfriend, who's an landscape archaeologist. So she's out on the, living on the in a teepee somewhere right now.
Perfect.
And my daughter, Anna Geislinger, is a prop stylist and does set dressing and art direction.
I love
commercials and music videos, and they both love what they do. They work so hard and they're so happy and fulfilled because they're doing what they love. Even in this world we're living in now, which is a little scary, not a little scary, a lot scary.
A lot of scary.
Last week was pretty damn scary.
Yeah.
They are, soldiering on. That's all we can do. So.
As you say, to do what you love, and to be able to share that joy with your family.
Yeah.
It's pretty damn cool.
The best. Well, it looks like that's what you guys are doing too. That's wonderful.
It does. It makes me laugh when you say your daughter was filming you through an iPhone, because that's what I had to do most of COVID with him.
Yeah.
And all I kept thinking was people on TCM are watching something that I shot with my phone in his office. He's not even wearing pants and I'm filming him, it is amazing. So people are watching you on Netflix, care of your daughter.
Yeah.
It's amazing what we can do.
I know. It really is. I'm so glad about the technology that I don't have to figure out that my daughter.
Yes. That's right.
That's
right.
Why we're here. That's why you had us.
Yes. That's true.
That's our purpose. Purpose in life.
That's exactly your purpose. Yes.
Well, keep on.
It's a pleasure.
You too. It was lovely to talk to you. Thanks for talking about stuff that was fun and not just boring.
We try.
You did a good job.
Thank you, Annette.
Take care.
But what fun.
Again, there's a reason certain people work for a really long time. Wouldn't you want her on your set?
Yep.
Wouldn't you want her in your team of people,
Exactly. Because it's not just the acting.
No.
It's the teamwork.
Yeah.
It's the presence. It's the contribution that they make to the esprit de corps.
The esprit de corps. God forbid.
To the camaraderie, if you prefer.
No, anyway. it's you know, you meet some people, and as I say, you just sort of go, yeah, I would like to spend ridiculous hours with you. Absolutely.
And why not?
Wait, come on. Where's your terrible segue? You can do it. And if people want to spend terrible hours with us.
And if people want to spend more time with us, how do they go about doing that?
Well, you are at Leonard Maltin. I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You are also on Facebook. And you can go to our YouTube channel, which is Maltin on Movies. We do a live stream every Sunday and we answer your questions. We talk movies. You show off some of your very cool collectibles. And it's a fun time.
Join us, won't you?
Mm.
And you can also join us on Patreon, patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. That's where you can help support what we do.
And we appreciate it
so much. And help us continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll keep doing it as long as we can. That's it for now. See you next time, folks.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.